Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis for you, as usual. The bad and the crazy. I mean, we see weird stuff all the time, but both of those just take the cake. But the good one is good. And this comes from the Washington Post that says the chief judge of the district's federal court issued an unusual order Wednesday apologizing to the public and the media for not making certain court documents widely available online. The gesture of transparency by U.S. District Court Judge Royce C. Lamberth comes at a time when the Obama administration is under scrutiny for an unprecedented number of leak investigations, including one showing that the Justice Department had secretly probed the news gathering activities of Fox News reporter James Rosen. Goes on to say that a federal judge had ordered the documents unsealed in November of 2011, Jim, but they were kept sealed for 18 months and not posted on the court's docket online until last week. Lamberth saying that things need to change to make sure all this transparency actually takes place. So once again, bureaucracy gumming up the works, and poor James Rosen didn't even know about it until a few days ago. Meanwhile, the government here has been putting together a ridiculous case against him for almost 4 years.
Well, it also says how convenient some of these bureaucratic errors are for the government, aren't they, Greg? You know, kind of all the documents that could get delayed in posting, it's kind of intriguing that one that would have created a controversy well before the election would be there and would have created, you know, this really could very well could have consumed a good portion of quite a few news cycles during the presidential election. Having said that, Greg, I'm really glad just to hear somebody apologize for something in recent days. You know, it's kind of, because, you know, you say we have a very sorry group of people governing us right now. So it's nice to hear them finally saying that they're sorry for something like this. And just kind of a quick note on Rosen and these things. Look, we want the government to protect its confidential information. We want things that are secret for genuine, good, solid national security reasons to stay secret. We don't want people to have their lives endangered or the bad guys to know how we're following them or what we know about them and stuff like that. What many people during the previous administration and many people in this administration have said is that the classification process has basically run amok and that really routine information gets classified. And there's an effort to kind of how strictly they enforce the effort to not leak information basically comes down to not whether it's really vital to national security, but whether it's damaging to priorities of a particular administration. Now, in the case of these AP reporters, look, there's nothing wrong with trying to find a leak. The problem is when you start looking at the reporters and you start doing these blanket efforts to seize phone records and who to see who they're talking to, you're supposed to start the other way. You're supposed to be looking for the leak, not work your way backwards from the media institution that published the information. Because it's, you know, even going back to the Pentagon Papers, there has never been an effort that it is a criminal, that is an actual crime to print classified information. It is a crime to leak classified information. So it's the whistleblower, the person who has the classified information and is telling it to somebody he shouldn't. That is the crime, and that's what's supposed to be prosecuted. Even back during the Pentagon Papers days, judges could do an injunction to say, don't publish this until this issue has been resolved. But there's never been a situation in which any reporter has been sent to jail or fined or seen as committing a crime. And that's where the conspiracy charge against Rosen seems so outlandish. And so I'm glad that this judge is recognizing some wrongdoing here. I'd really like to see an apology for the idea that that they could effectively criminalize journalism, and that, you know, if somebody who has access to classified information hands it to you, that by taking it and publishing it, you have committed a crime, when in fact the actual crime is committed by the leaker there. So, you know, maybe we're getting a little bit of a check, and some people involved in this process are realizing how they've been party to basically a wholesale tearing down of the First Amendment here.
Jim, I just want to clarify that you have an unfettered right to exercise the freedom of the press, but there needs to be a balance.
Well, Fetter basically has now become a synonym for bother the administration.
Yeah, exactly. All right, on to martini number two now. And, you know, we're obviously, sadly, used to terrorist attacks, particularly in the past decade or two. But what we saw yesterday just outside London with these two guys in broad daylight, these two animals, essentially, attacking what we believe to be a member of the British military just outside a British military post, attacking him. First, they hit him with a car. Then they just attacked him with meat cleavers and knives and machetes. They tried to behead him. Some reports suggest that they basically succeeded in that. people just watching this for minutes on end, some of them filming it, just tells you where our world is right now. And then one of them actually got one of the terrorists on camera with this little rant.
We must fight them as they fight us, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I apologize that women had to witness this today, but in our land, our women have to see the same. You people will never be safe. Remove your government. They don't care about you.
Throughout the attack, they shouted Allahu Akbar, and unlike our government, Jim, the British actually believe that they know what motivated this, and that would be radical Islam. But talk about taking it to a new barbaric extreme.
Yeah, a couple different wrinkles and aspects to this. One, kind of horrifying that no one was able to intervene. I mean, at that certain, keep in mind, this is a country that does not have a Second Amendment. There is no private legal ownership of firearms by the British citizenry or in very rare circumstances. Clearly, no one around that circumstance was armed, and it's very difficult to run up and stop somebody who's got a knife. Having said that, this does remind you of that late 1970s case of people hearing a woman being raped and murdered in New York City and not responding. Kind of this sense of, like, what do you do? And it kind of says that there's a disturbing passivity or maybe even just a sense of powerlessness on the part of the British citizens who, you know, hopefully when you see a crime, you can do something about it. And this may apparently has been sucked right out of the British citizenry. Also, by the way, keep in mind, apparently it took 20 minutes for armed authorities to respond to this, that there were police nearby, but your average British policeman does not necessarily carry a firearm. And I think that it was a long time. Your average British bobby, we all know the kind of uniform, they would carry a nightstick, but they did not have a gun. And I remember, I think it was Robin Williams used to do a joke about saying the British policeman's cry was, stop, or I'll say stop again. Instead of saying stop or I'll shoot was not an option for the British policeman. I think the level of danger and menace in British society may require them to re-examine whether police need to be armed in circumstances like this. And it does kind of point to this, circumstance of, is disarming your citizenry such a good idea? Because this means that anybody who's got a sharp knife like this guy on the street now is much more dangerous to a largely unarmed public around them. On the one hand, you're right. It is good that the UK did come out and say this is, when you start ranting at passersby about why you're doing this, it's really not a big question of this. I was a little unnerved to hear David Cameron saying something like the best way to respond to this is to go on with our lives.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, I get that. I understand this idea that you don't want to live in fear. You don't want to lock your doors. You don't want to indicate that, the actions of a few jackals can make you cower in your homes and afraid to live your life as you're supposed to. On the flip side, if you decide to ignore a problem, how different is your behavior in that circumstance? There's a fine line there. And you can't, what's the line between downplaying this and saying, we're the British, we have a stiff upper lip. We're not going to let two guys, change the way we view our world or alter our behavior. And I kind of hope that MI5 and all the other domestic agencies over there are really going over all their lists of folks who they have on their watch lists, et cetera, because you'd hate to see this guy being the opening and having lots of copycats or something like that. We're in urban time in the United Kingdom and not quite yet clear that the British government has a handle on this.
No, I don't think so at all. And, he said the right thing, which is we will not bow to terrorism. But Britain has gotten extremely submissive to Sharia. There are different pockets in and around London, other parts of Britain, where Sharia pretty much runs the show. And in that type of environment, a lot of radicals can find motivation in all the wrong places. And a lot of different terrorism experts believe that's happening, particularly in the UK. So hopefully we do not see what you just mentioned there. And that's more attacks like this, because that's about as base as you can get in terms of human conduct. On to martini number three now, and we've obviously chronicled the situation with the IRS targeting conservative organizations to a great degree. A couple different pieces on National Review Online adding additional concern about this. We'll focus much more on one than the other. One is simply that this has not stopped yet. There are still conservative organizations that are getting strung along by the IRS as they apply for tax-exempt status. But now it's not just donors. It's not just politically conservative organizations. Now, David French, your colleague, reports in a story called IRS Morality, Defend Planned Parenthood, Deluge Adoptive Families with Audits. Essentially, 90% of tax returns claiming the adoption tax credit received additional scrutiny, and 69% of those people actually got audited by the IRS because of the dastardly activity of adopting a child, Jim.
Of all the problems facing the United States, and of all the problems involving whether or not people are paying their fair share of taxes. How on God's green earth are adoptive parents really the big problem that you'd want to focus a lot of resources on? I had said this, you know, semi-tongue-in-cheek yesterday on Twitter, that if you adopt a child, Greg, I think you should be allowed to cheat on your taxes. Not a ton. You know, we don't want to discourage scoff laws and you know, but really, you are doing such a great social good. Opening up your home and your heart to a child that needs a loving home. It involves such an enormous financial sacrifice. It involves such an enormous effort to, you know, turn your life upside down, but it makes such a difference in a child's life that really we're going to quibble over a couple grand in taxes, you know. And then it turns out that in, like, I believe it was like 1%, it turns out that basically people were, you know, not paying what they should or inappropriately taking a certain deduction or something like that. So an enormous amount of resources reviewing this type. And as you say, 69% of people taking a deduction getting audited just seems wildly inappropriate. You know, there's no way that's coincidental. And it just kind of seems like a bizarre place to focus, you know, what are limited IRS resources. Once again, in light of the other IRS abuses we've seen, seems to fit a pattern of abusing particular groups, really not out of any particular, you know, logic or tax code legal reasoning, but just out of spite. That, you know, basically, if you're an adoptive parent, I guess the thinking is you're more likely to be conservative, and thus you're not on the side of this administration, and thus you deserve to have your refund held up and a lot of, you know, dragged in front of the IRS and need to generate tons and tons of paperwork. I mean, the IRS has basically become very tough to distinguish from an official government harassment institution. Now we see it's not random who gets picked for audits.
Yeah, you exactly brought up the point that I was going to. How do we even know that, you know, adoptive parents are likely to be more conservative? They're not part of specific organizations. They're not necessarily donors. I mean, this is just insane. And, you know, you have to wonder whether it's the way that this administration generally looks at the life issue, you know, and if you tell people there's an adoption option, then they're probably more likely to have their child. And for some people, that's just not a good thing, I guess. But kudos to those who have not only adopted children, but have survived the IRS unnecessary onslaught. We salute you, and hopefully the fact that this got some attention thanks to National Review means that will not be continuing. Jim, sorry to end on two horrific martinis, but we'll talk to you tomorrow.
It's been a generally horrific week. Better luck tomorrow, folks. See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.